Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. Today on the show, we have reports from Susan Shan and Anna Mateo. Later, Jill Robbins brings us Ask a Teacher. And we close the show with our program, American Stories. Today we hear Love of Life by Jack London. But first, Iran has denied reports that one of its missiles hit a Ukrainian passenger airplane. The Ukraine International Airlines jet crashed earlier this week near Tehran, killing all 176 people on board. Iranian officials called on the United States and Canada Friday to share any information they have on the crash. The plane broke up just hours after Iran launched missiles at two air bases in neighboring Iraq. The bases housed U.S. troops. Iran launched the attacks to answer the killing of its top general in a U.S. airstrike last week. The downed aircraft was carrying 63 Canadians. On Thursday, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said, "The evidence indicates that the plane was shot down by an Iranian surface-to-air missile." He noted the information came from several intelligence sources. U.S. officials said that Iran might have mistakenly identified the Boeing 737 as a threat. Ali Abedzadeh is head of Iran's National Aviation Office. He said Friday, "What we can say with certainty is that no missile hit the plane." He urged Western nations to, in his words, come and show their findings to the world. Western governments may not be ready to share the information because it comes from highly classified intelligence sources. However, the Associated Press, the New York Times, and other media companies released videos appearing to show something hitting a plane near Tehran's main airport. In one video from the Associated Press, someone off camera says, "The plane has caught fire. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. God, please help us. Call the fire department." The comments were made in Farsi, the official language of Iran. Shortly after the crash, Iran reported the recovery of the plane's flight recorders, or black boxes. Abedzadeh announced, "We prefer to download the black boxes in Iran. But if we see that we can't do that because the boxes are damaged, then we will seek help." The head of the Iranian investigation team said that the process could take more than a month and that the investigation could stretch into next year. Under United Nations aviation rules, the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB, can join the investigation because the crash involved an airplane designed and built in the U.S. The NTSB said Thursday night that its involvement could be limited by U.S. sanctions on Iran. U.S. officials have expressed concern about sending employees to Iran because of the heightened tensions. Iran had first said it would not let Boeing, the plane's manufacturer, take part in the investigation. The state-operated IRNA news agency later reported that Iran has invited both Ukraine and the Boeing company to participate in the investigations. In Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky said, "The missile theory is not ruled out, but it has not been confirmed yet." The government said it wanted to search the crash site for any sign of a Russian-made missile used by Iran. A preliminary Iranian report released Thursday noted that the plane's pilots never made a radio call for help. The report said that an emergency problem happened just minutes after the flight left Tehran.
The third year of Donald Trump's presidency seems likely to be remembered more for his impeachment than for anything else. But a look at economic data shows that the United States economy expanded in 2019. In fact, many economic numbers appear to confirm much of Trump's claims about the economy. There are worries about the future, but the main economic measures rose, overcoming the effects of the trade war with China. However, a tax cut and large increase in the national debt guarantee that interest payments will take up an increasing share of the federal budget. At the same time, if there is any sign of weakness in the U.S. economy, the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, could find it does not have the tools to influence events. Trump promised to create more jobs when he campaigned for the presidency in 2016. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reports the country has added about 6.8 million of them since then. During Trump's first 2 years in office, economic growth rose sharply. Between 2011 and 2016, the gross domestic product, GDP, increased by about 2% each year. In Trump's first 2 years, that average increased to 2.9%. In 2019, however, GDP appeared likely to end the year at a 2.1% rate of growth. Economists suggest the slowdown is partly the result of American policies in international trade. In 2019, Trump escalated a trade war with China. He placed tariffs on hundreds of billions of dollars worth of imports. So, China ordered tariffs on imports from the United States. As a result, Americans have paid tens of billions of dollars more for Chinese products than they would have without the tariffs. And U.S. exporters have suffered business losses. The money that comes to the U.S. government from the higher tariffs has gone to farmers, whose products have been affected by the Chinese tariffs. Trump announced in early December that he would order tariffs on steel from Brazil and Argentina. He also promised to put a 100% tariff on some imports from France. Clearly, the president is not backing away from his decision. Economists and other experts will warn that the stock market is not the economy, and they are correct. But stock prices do show that investors believe the economy will continue growing, because they have continued to rise. In early 2019, the financial markets were coming off a period of unrest, but worries about their future growth left as the year continued. Major markets show year-to-date returns of between 20% and 25% through early December. Interest rates have been part of economic concerns since before Trump took office. With the economy growing and unemployment decreasing, most Americans expected wages would rise. That would drive up prices and lead to higher inflation. But that did not happen. While the economy was adding millions of jobs, wages did not grow, and inflation has been below 2%. During a long period of economic growth, the federal government usually sets aside a lot of money or pays off its debt. But under Trump, that has not happened. Instead, the U.S. federal debt has increased every year and is now more than $22 trillion. The increased debt worries people because of the share of the federal budget that must be used to pay interest. Experts warn that amount will only grow if the United States enters a recession. I'm Susan Shand.
One of the most popular board games in the United States is now becoming very popular across parts of Asia. Young people from countries such as Malaysia, Thailand, Sri Lanka, and Pakistan have taken up the game and are winning Scrabble tournaments. Tengu Arif Shah is a teenager who can spell more English words than most native English speakers. He says he may not know what every word means, but that is not important. "It's a puzzle. It stimulates my mind," he told the Reuters news agency recently. Arif says he loves unusual words. In a recent tournament, he played the word S-E-N-V-Y, an old word for mustard plants or seeds. He says one day he would love to get the letters to play C-W-T-C-H-I-N-G, a Welsh word for cuddling. Scrabble is a board game played with small square pieces called tiles. Every tile has a letter on it. Players get 7 tiles to start with and then take turns making words. Each tile is worth a certain number of points. When all the tiles are placed on the board, the players add up their points. The player with the most points wins. The building designer Alfred M. Butz is said to have invented the game in the 1930s. At the time, he called it crisscross words. Later, the game was redesigned and renamed Scrabble, and its popularity grew. Scrabble tournaments have been held in the United States since at least the 1970s. However, the last 3 youth Scrabble champions have come from Asia. The last 3 adult champions have come from New Zealand, Australia, and Britain. The popularity of Scrabble in Asia has not gone unnoticed by governments. Many officials in Asian countries support after-school Scrabble clubs for young people to build English language skills. Many parents see it as a fun way for kids to learn. Malaysia's Ganesh Asirvatam is currently the top-ranked adult player. He says Scrabble is becoming a developmental tool in Asia, a continent of more than 2,000 languages. He told reporters that Asian players are conquering the Scrabble world. Some say Scrabble became more popular in Asia after a world-famous player moved there 20 years ago. New Zealander Nigel Richards is a 5-time world Scrabble champion. He is widely considered the game's greatest player. In 2015 and 2018, Richards even won Scrabble's French tournament, although he cannot speak French. He studied the French dictionary for 9 weeks. The winner of this year's Scrabble Youth Tournament, Thailand's Tharin Paro, calls Richards one of his Scrabble heroes. The teen once beat Richards during a tournament in India. Tharin told Reuters, "Everyone wants to be world champion at least once. Even if I get world champion," he said, "I don't think I would ever stop playing." I'm Ana Mateo.
Many VOA Learning English fans write to us with this question: how do I get better at speaking English? Dear VOA fan, first, try to speak English each day, even if you can only speak for a short time. Begin by saying good morning and good afternoon or evening to a family member or a friend. As you travel to your school or work, think about how you feel, like happy or sad, and say it to yourself in English. When you arrive, find a friend who is also learning English and ask, "How are you feeling today?" Speaking English every day will help you get better. We all make mistakes. You will probably make some mistakes while learning to speak English. But you can still say how you feel, and you can learn from your mistakes. Ask your friend or teacher to correct them. Practice saying the words many times so you can say them correctly the next time. Another way to practice speaking is to read a story from our website and listen to the audio. Stop after a few sentences. Listen again and notice how the speaker's voice goes up and down. Repeat the sentences and make your voice change the same way. The more you practice, the more you will sound like a native speaker. With a friend, choose a conversation from Let's Learn English and learn together. Then, when you know it well enough, act it out with your friend. Use a phone to record and listen to yourself. Do you say the words the same way as Anna and her friends? Next week, we will talk about continuing a conversation in English. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Jill Robbins.
Love of Life by Jack London. Part 1.
The two men moved painfully down the bank and fell among the rocks that were scattered everywhere. They were tired and weak. Their faces showed the patient appearance that results from difficulty long endured. They were heavily burdened with blanket packs, which were tied to their shoulders. Each man carried a gun. They walked in a leaning position, the shoulders forward, the head farther forward, the eyes fixed upon the ground.
"I wish we had a couple of those cartridges that are lying in our cache," said the second man. His voice was completely without expression. And the first man, walking into the milky stream that flowed over the rocks, made no reply. The other man followed at his heels. They did not remove their shoes, although the water was icy cold. It was so cold that their feet soon were without feeling. In places, the water dashed against their knees, and both men found it difficult to remain standing. The man who followed slipped upon a smooth rock and nearly fell. He recovered his footing with great effort, at the same time uttering a sharp cry of pain. He seemed faint and stretched one hand forward, seeking support against the air. When he had steadied himself, he stepped forward. But he slipped again and nearly fell.
Then he stood still and looked at the other man, who had never turned his head. The man stood still for fully a minute, as if he were deciding something. Then he called out,
I say, Bill, I hurt my foot.
Bill struggled ahead through the milky water. He did not look around. The man watched him go, and although his face lacked expression as before, his eyes had the look of a wounded animal. The other man climbed the farther bank of the stream and continued straight ahead, without looking back. The man in the stream watched him. His lips trembled a little.
Bill!
He cried. It was the despairing cry of a strong man in trouble, but Bill's head did not turn. The man watched him go, struggling forward up the hill toward the skyline. He watched him go until he passed over the hilltop and disappeared. Then he turned his gaze and slowly examined the circle of the world that remained to him, now that Bill was gone. The sun was low in the sky, almost hidden by a cover of clouds. The man looked at his watch while supporting his weight on one leg. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The season was near the end of July or the 1st of August. He did not know the exact date within a week or two, but that was enough to know that the sun marked the northwest. He looked to the south and decided that somewhere beyond those hills lay the Great Bear Lake. Also, he knew that behind the same hills, the Arctic Circle cut its way across the plains of northern Canada, called the Barrens. This stream in which he stood flowed into the Coppermine River, which in turn flowed north and emptied into the Arctic Ocean. He had never been there, but he had seen it once on a map. Again, his gaze completed the circle of the world about him. It was not a cheerful sight. Everywhere was soft skyline. The hills were all low-lying. There were no trees, no grasses. There was nothing but a vast emptiness that brought fear into his eyes.
Bill!
He whispered once and twice.
Bill!
He stood trembling in the milky water, feeling the vastness pressing in upon him with great force. He began to shake as with a disease, until the gun falling from his hand into the stream brought him back to reality. He fought with his fear and regained his self-control. He recovered the gun from the water. He pushed his pack more toward his left shoulder. This helped to take a portion of its weight off the foot he had hurt. Then he proceeded slowly and carefully, in great pain, to the bank of the stream. He did not stop, with a worry that was madness, unmindful of the pain. He hurried up the hill to the top over which his companion had disappeared. But at the top he saw a valley empty of life. He fought with his fear again and won. Then once more he moved the pack farther toward his left shoulder and struggled down the hill. The bottom of the valley was very wet. Thick plant life held the moisture close to the surface, and the water flowed from under his feet at every step. He picked his way carefully across the valley and followed the other man's footsteps along the rocks, which made small islands in the sea of wet plant life. Although alone, he was not lost. Farther on, he knew, he would come to where dead pine trees bordered the shore of a little lake. In the language of that country, it was called the Land of Little Sticks. Into that lake flowed a small stream, the water of which was not milky. There was grass along that stream, but no trees. He would follow the stream until it divided. He would cross this place of dividing to another stream flowing to the west. This he would follow until it emptied into the River Dease. Here he would find a cache under an upturned boat covered with many rocks. In this cache there would be cartridges for his empty gun, and fish hooks and lines. Everything he needed for catching food would be there. Also, he would find flour, a little meat, and some beans. Bill would be waiting for him there, and they would find a boat and row south down the Dease to the Great Bear Lake. And south across the lake they would go, ever south, until they came to the Mackenzie River. And south, always south they would go, while the winter raced after them, and the ice formed in the streams, and the days grew cold. South they would go, to some warm place where the trees grew tall and full, and there was food without end. These were the thoughts of the man as he struggled forward, but as strongly as he struggled with his body, he struggled equally with his mind. He tried to believe that Bill had not deserted him. Surely Bill would wait for him at the cache. He was forced to think this thought, otherwise there would not be any reason to continue, and he would lie down and die. As the ball of the sun sank slowly into the northwest, he recalled every inch of his and Bill's flight south ahead of the oncoming winter, and he thought again and again of the food in the cache. It had been 2 days since he had anything to eat. It was a far longer time since he had had enough to eat. Often he picked muskeg berries, put them into his mouth, and ate them. A muskeg berry is a small seed in a drop of water. In the mouth, the water melts away and the seed tastes bitter. The man knew there was no real food value in the berries, but he ate them, patiently, with a hope greater than his experience. At 9 o'clock that night, he hit his toe on a rocky surface, and from weakness and tiredness, he fell to the ground. He lay for some time without movement on his side. He took his pack from his back and dragged himself into a sitting position. It was not yet dark. While some light remained, he felt among the rocks for pieces of dried plants. When he had gathered a pile, he built a fire and put a tin pot of water on it to boil. He unwrapped his pack. The first thing he did was to count his matches. There were 67. He counted them 3 times to be sure. He divided them into several portions, wrapping them in paper. He put one portion in his empty tobacco pack, another in the inside band of his hat, and a third under his shirt against his flesh. This accomplished, he began to worry whether he had counted correctly. He unwrapped them all and counted them again. Yes, there were 67. He dried his wet shoes and socks by the fire. The moccasins were badly torn. His socks were worn through in places and his feet were bleeding. The area between his foot and leg, the ankle, was very painful. He examined it. It had swelled until it was as large as his knee. He cut a long strip from one of his 2 blankets and bound the ankle tightly. He cut other strips and bound them about his feet to serve both for moccasins and socks. Then he drank the pot of hot water, wound his watch, and pulled his blankets around him. He slept like a dead man. The brief darkness at midnight came and went. Then the sun rose in the northeast. It can be better said that day dawned in that quarter of the sky because the sun was hidden by gray clouds. At 6 o'clock in the morning, he waked, quietly, lying on his back. He gazed straight up into the gray sky and knew that he was hungry. As he lifted himself on his elbow, he was frightened by a loud noise. There was a caribou looking at him curiously. The animal was not more than 50 feet away, and instantly into the man's mind came the picture of caribou meat cooking over a fire. From habit, he reached for the empty gun and aimed it. The caribou leaped away and disappeared across the rocks.
That's our show for today. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.
This is